For the Climate Discussion Nexus, I'm John Robson, with the latest readout video from our free Wednesday Wake Up email newsletter, and also hello to viewers in Norway, who've made it number 11 on our all-time list of views by jurisdiction. And if you're starting to think that the roots of the English language might lie in a Germanic Scandinavian setting in the last millennium, we say ja, spelled J-A, not Y-E-A-H, followed by Wo sind Sie? Because our lead story this week was this big blackout in Berlin that was subject to something of a North American media blackout, including the fact that it seems to have been caused by the radical left Volcano Group, or Vulkangruppe, as a protest against hydrocarbon energy, and that it took some skill, but not much foresight, since the resulting chaos, misery, and danger actually reminded people how crucial that energy was, rather than turning them against it. Absurdly, according to Deutsche Welle, which is Germany's international broadcaster, these maniacs, in a letter cutting off the ruler's power, quote, maintain that widespread blackouts were not the intended outcome. Rather, their aim was to strike at the fossil fuel industry, end quote. Which means they didn't realize that it's what was keeping the lights on. But how many nonviolent net zero advocates also don't realize that shutting down hydrocarbon energy will hurt people who depend on it for heat, light, and much, much more. Oh, one more thing. Fritz Fahrenholt observed that a great weakness of the German Energiewende and all such schemes is that the, quote, narrowing of the energy supply down to a single energy carrier, end quote, though soothingly dubbed sector coupling, actually makes the whole economy and society more brittle, since if man or nature knocks out electricity, oil, gasoline, or natural gas, once upon a time it would only have shut down some appliances and facilities. But in the green new world, when the wires go, everything goes. And another thing, or actually the same thing, because we are driven to return to our point from last week about children still knowing what snow is, especially in Britain, given how the winter weather just keeps getting worse. Though we did have to laugh at the 2 feet of snow in Scotland image. And we had to laugh at the British green industrialist and noisemaker who posted on December 23rd, quote, if you're dreaming of a white Christmas, dream on. Snow is fast becoming a thing of the past in Britain, end quote. But we have to concede at the same time that cold that you're not prepared for is no laughing matter. And since climate alarmists are prone to say the science is simple, the results linear, and the predictions rock solid, we need to ask where, quote, Europe's Arctic storm chaos, end quote, was on their bingo card, or, quote, thousands of passengers camp out at frozen Dutch airport while snow-hit France closes motorways and cancels flights as death toll climbs, end quote. Or Alaska having its snowiest December in 80 years. Oh, sure, after the fact they say, yeah, we predicted or we could have predicted it, you know, jet stream, polar vortex, something, something, climate. But which of them actually predicted such headlines in 2026? Or that, if Ryan Mao is correct, we're in, quote, the snowiest January in history for the Northern Hemisphere, end quote, probably exceeding those in the cold but relatively dry Little Ice Age. And if they couldn't predict any of that, how much of the stuff that they confidently tell us would happen in the past 10 years or will happen in the next 10 can be relied on? Pretty much none of it. Oh, and the editorial board of the Washington Post recently noted that Democratic New York Governor Kathy Hochul has disconnected the requirement not to connect new buildings to natural gas and agreed to the first natural gas pipeline in the state in a decade or more. Moreover, in explaining these changes, Governor Hochul cites not just affordability, but also reality. And if political reality is forcing her to acknowledge economic reality, well, that kind of thing is sort of the justification for democratic self-government now, isn't it? On the other hand, Canada's upstart Juno News calculates that international green man of mystery Mark Carney is about to embark on his 32nd plane trip since becoming Prime Minister a mere 9 months ago. Tell us the one about carbon footprints again, Mr. Where'd he just go? China? And from the So You Admit It file, Climate Home News emails, quote, Happy New Year from all of us here at Climate Home News and a warm welcome back after the festive period, end quote. Right. Warm good, cold bad. And Then it tries to give away 5 copies of, quote, The Climate Diplomat, A Personal History of the COP Conferences, completely free, end quote. You'd struggle to sell such a tome. Now, from the You Sort of Admit It file, the Deep Blue Washington State Department of Commerce just put out a press release saying that things funded under the State Climate Commitment Act only achieved about 4% of what they'd claimed. But they brush it off as a simple error, though at an awkward time. For instance, when lots of people are starting to think that your policies are as bad as your analysis. And then from the Cool, that's a classic file, Canada has just banned the compact fluorescent bulbs that it pretty much forced on us about 20 years ago by banning incandescents. As Blacklock's reporter reminds us, during a 2003 mass giveaway of the poisonous things, a federal fact sheet sent to Canadian homes blared, "Are compact fluorescent bulbs safe? Yes!" exclamation mark. They have a minute amount of mercury. If they break, they do not pose a health risk, end quote. Well, apart from the bit where you had to evacuate pets and children, open the windows, and wait 15 minutes before venturing in with gloves, as they admitted in 2014. But by now, there are about 100 million of these little bombs, which it is now illegal to make or import, and many of them, we suspect, are being snuck into landfills in the regular trash because various household electronic waste programs shun them as too toxic. But lithium-ion batteries are safe, the government assures you. In the newsletter, we also praise Roger Pilkey Jr. for always giving us something to think about, even when we disagree with him. Which we do, at least partway, when he opposes Donald Trump pulling the U.S. out of 66 international agencies, including the IPCC and the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, UNFCCC, to insiders. Pilkey Jr. writes that, quote, leaving the IPCC and UNFCCC is bad for the United States, end quote, because, quote, multilateralism matters for normal Americans, end quote. But we respectfully dissent on two grounds. One of them, the very big one, is that far too many people take for granted and assume as normal the long American engagement with a liberal global order after 1945. But the much longer and deeper U.S. tradition is unilateralism tinged with isolationism. In fact, it took a great deal of vision and courage for statesmen in both parties in the 1940s, including, for instance, long-forgotten Republican Senator Arthur Vandenberg of Michigan, to get the United States into outfits like NATO and the World Bank. And those who benefited from the long Pax Americana that resulted should have done a lot more to praise Washington and to pull their own weight instead of being scornful freeloaders, which too many still are. So these people need shaking up. Our more detailed rebuttal starts with Abba Eban's immortal statement, quote, a consensus means that everyone agrees to say collectively what no one believes individually, end quote. Now, Pilkey Jr. may be right that, quote, the U.S. helped to create the IPCC in the 1980s to push back against climate activism perceived to be contrary to U.S. interests, notably that based on flawed or exaggerated scientific claims, end quote. But he's wrong to believe that the IPCC has, on balance, effectively pushed back on flawed or exaggerated scientific claims. Oh, sure, the detailed working papers are often quite sound, but they are distorted from within and from without. So ask yourself this. If the IPCC did not exist, would the zealots and hangers-on be less prone or more prone to claim that there's this huge scientific consensus? And also ask yourself, if absent Donald Trump's calming influence, or Joe Biden's, the IPCC becomes as loony left as the advocates and activists claim that it already is, will it make the global warming scare more credible or more absurd? In the newsletter, we also note that it's tempting to think of cold as an actual presence, not just the absence of heat, especially if you encounter it in all its fury, stabbing like a driven nail, without the modern miracle, in entrepreneur Michael Binion's phrase, of hydrocarbon energy that helps us build weather-resistant buildings and then heat them. If it were minus 21 Celsius and you lived in a mud hut, you wouldn't live long. But even in modern houses, you have to take care. As the UK Met Office warned, courtesy of Age Scotland's policy director, whatever that might be, quote, if heating your home is a challenge, try and stay warm in the room or place you will spend most of your time by wearing layered clothing, taking warm drinks and food with some regular movement to help with circulation, and keeping your muscles active, end quote. Okay, but why is heating our homes a challenge? Because the nitwits in charge decided that warmth was so deadly that they had to trash the energy sector to make it stop. In which case, stupidity also feels like an active malign presence right in your house, not just the absence of intelligence. In the newsletter, we also continue our deep dive into last summer's U.S. Department of Energy Red Team Climate Report, this week plunging into Chapter 5 on the awkward discrepancies between models and observations, which starts with a brief explanation of how modelers actually have to make a lot of guesses and assumptions because so many climate processes happen on too small a scale for the computers to represent them accurately. You know, we call them models, as if they modeled the processes that we know are going on. But the fact is that instead of trying to understand what really happens, because they couldn't model it even if they did, they try to kludge together equations that happen to match inputs to outputs. But even though they know the outputs, the result is a mess in which the settled science of climate modeling doesn't just disagree about little things, they diverge widely on big basic ones like what the current average temperature is. It's not just bizarre, it's impudent that we keep being told how much warmer it is than in 1850 to two spurious decimal places when the top models actually generate estimates of current temperature that span about 2.5 degrees Celsius, which is more than double the estimated 20th century warming. And don't get us started on the precision of temperatures 175 years ago. But surely at least they get warming trends for their very recent past, right, don't they? I mean, they think it was this temperature 25 years ago and that temperature today? Incredibly, no, most of them don't. And the ones that do make up mechanisms, because they're not modeling them, that render the climate relatively insensitive to CO2. So it should be the mathematical equivalent of child's play to match inputs and outputs when you know them both, but most models predict far more warming than actually occurred. Almost as if the modelers liked it that way. And speaking of models versus data, Javier Vinos recently posted a detailed essay on Judith Curry's blog discussing the remarkable global warming event of 2023-24, which left climate modelers scratching their digital heads. In 2024, he argued that it was likely due to the 2023 underwater Hunga Tonga volcano injecting huge amounts of the key greenhouse gas dihydrogen oxide into the atmosphere. But climate science officialdom said, oh, no. That volcano caused net cooling just like above water ones, so it must be something else. Say, man-made CO2. Yeah, that's the ticket. So, in mid-2025, Vinos replied with a testable proposition. He said the warming would reverse over the coming 2 to 3 years, not keep surging. And now he says, told you so, global sea surface temperatures are almost back to where they were in 2022, as I predicted, but the climate models didn't. So no, the science is not settled, and sometimes it takes a well-informed outsider like Vinos to point out the problems. Finally, from the co2science.org archive, this week's plant is native to Ontario and the Northeast US, and it goes by the pleasant name of Spring Avens. And we couldn't find any mention of people blasting it as an invasive weed or calling it toxic to horses or any of the usual complaints we seem to read about the world's plants. So, here's to Guillaume Vernonum with its dainty little flowers. And in 2013, a pair of experiments showed that an additional 300 parts per million of CO2 in the air caused an average 35.5% increase in its growth. Go Spring Avens! For the Climate Discussion Nexus, I'm John Robson, and I know Dunkelheit and Kalt when I see them.